Hydropolitics, what it is and why it matters. It's the last of your talks this quarter, and I'm hoping that you will get out of here one thing, that politics is not as bad of it's not as bad of a word or a practice or a process or a thing as we usually think about. And why do I say that? I say that because it is something that is very, very pervasive in social order. I remember almost about 2 years ago, I was coming back from Birmingham, and I happened to share a flight with a lady, or share the same seat. We were sitting right next to each other, and we started talking. She was from New York, and she had just visited her daughter in Birmingham, and she was going back home. And we started talking, and she found out that I had just spoken about hydropolitics. And she moved, she sort of moved away from me as if she wanted to get out of the plane, because I'm sitting right next to a politician. And then we kept talking, and she said, you have an accent, and where are you from? I said, I'm from Africa. And she said, you're from Africa, and you're a politician? I said, well, I'm not a politician. But she said, well, I hate politicians. And the reason why we hate politicians is because we often consider them to be people different from us. How many of you just stumbled into this seminar? You never knew that there was a seminar here. Very few. Knowledge is power. Power is the mechanism with which we do things. It comes from the basic physics principle of the ability to do work. And we call it politics because it's about humans. It's just the same concept of power, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. I'm pretty sure that the people out there at the university community, if they knew that there was a talk here today about hydropolitics, they would come here. But they're not here because they don't know. So knowledge in itself makes you a political agent. Just knowing that there is a talk here makes you a political agent. If you look at position and difference, those who are sitting in front, assuming that you have the same eyesight capabilities, those who are sitting in front are more able to accomplish or see what I'm talking about than those who are sitting behind. Your position gives you power to better accomplish something, like seeing and listening to me, than it would be if you were sitting behind. So just the position, it gives you power, and that's politics. And so politics is not something that you and I are not agents of it or practice. It's pervasive. It's so pervasive. Power relationships are the ways in which society sort of goes about doing its business. And because of that, politics is something that we should pay attention to, even though we usually don't. There's two kinds of politics. And before I talk about that, how many of you has been in a situation where you find yourself negotiating or trying to address an environmental problem or any kind of problem, and you get out of there and you say, boy, this was so political? How many of you has been in the same kinds of situations where you say, okay, we recognize that politics and power, that all of us sitting on this table have different kinds of power relationships, and those power relationships would influence the way we try to address this problem. So let's look at power. Who is bringing what kinds of power into this negotiation or process? And then see how we can work with those different power relationships. Nobody. And so, as we'll see later, there's two kinds of politics, or two kinds of ways in which politics has been defined. Aaron Hans and a whole bunch of his colleagues come from the political science side of things, and they think of politics as hydropolitics, as concerned with conflict and cooperation among states, usually over water resources that transcend international boundaries. The other school of thought, coming mostly from a group of scholars in South Africa that are mostly social scientists, including social psychologists and cultural anthropologists, they think that hydropolitics is just like politics, is the authoritative allocation of values with respect to water. And so it's not just about states. It's not just about water resources that are across different boundaries. It's about your drinking water. It's about the pollution and the health effects that you have as an individual. It's about the benefits that you get from either participating in recreational activities like swimming and boating. It's the benefit that you get for your property value that you have right next to a lake. And so it's really a whole bunch of power relationships that are actually operating at the scale at which you and I sort of go about with our daily lives. And so politics is not just a state, interstate, national thing. It's not just about elected officials and presidents or council members. It's about you and I as well. And so, if you unpack Tooton's definition, you would find out that politics is something that is ongoing. It's not static. Power relationships change over time. The ways in which we allocate those values, and by value here, I mean the different things, the different uses of water. I drink water because I value water because it serves me the purpose of drinking or taking a shower or washing my bike or the rain that falls on me when I'm biking. I value those things because I enjoy them. So those values are being allocated or are usually allocated through laws and policies and entails some kind of deliberative decision-making. People or politicians or political agents get together and decide on who gets what, how, and when. And because the values are not universal, so I might like drinking water better than I like skiing, and I have to do something with water that you don't think is important, and the decisions are made so that my use is accomplished and your value is not, I have avenue for contestation. So I can contest the decisions that are being made. And hydropolitics comes to play in the sense that it recognizes that those values are not universal. So I have different ways of valuing water, you have different ways of valuing water, and that in itself constitutes a difference, which in itself is an element of power that has to be sort of taken account of and brought to the table of making decisions about things. We also contest the legitimacy of authority, especially when we have, for example, the water supply system in Seattle and maybe the skiers club. There are two different people that are not managed by the same sort of authority. And just because we have more than one authority managing or making decisions that affect a whole bunch of different stakeholders, there is opportunities there for contestation. There is a political arena there for people to sort of get involved with and contest things. And of course, the issue of who gets what, which in this case is water, when, where, and how, and of course, how much as well, becomes an issue of contestation. We've already talked about hydropolitics spanning the scope of from the individual to states and, of course, interstates as well. And the ranges of issues that come with this definition include not just state and non-state actors, but the ways in which we claim and use water resources based on some of these values that might be social, political, psychological. I have a couple of friends who go to the mountains when there's snow, and then they put some weird shoes, and then they slide, and then they go back, and then they slide again. And I say, "What the hell are you doing?" So, well, it makes me feel good. Well, they're getting a psychological benefit, and water has a psychological value to them. Water in the form of snow has a psychological value to it. When that snow melts and fills the water downstream, some people use it for economic purposes, like industrial uses, and some people choose to be political about it in the real context of fighting for and claiming water resources, not necessarily for them, but for those who they ever think is their constituents. And so the implications of this is that we might find ourselves in instances where we're fighting over water resources, we are trying to mitigate that conflict. And the implications of that is that we might end up in a situation where there is peace, even if it's a false sense of peace. There are implications with gender. You might not see that in this culture very much. But if you go to places like Africa, most of the domestic water supply is provided by women and children. They've got power. When I was a kid and my mom, if we don't go to the stream, my dad won't have water to drink and won't have water to take a shower. So you get this gender implications in terms of who has power, who has the ability to accomplish some things about using water. And of course, there's all kinds of ecosystem power relationships. You think about the people who like salmon, sometimes just for psychological benefits or cultural values. And those of us who are into ecosystem or natural resources sciences, we actually truly believe that salmon should be moving up and down the stream, no matter how much we dam those streams and no matter how much we want to get electricity for it. And so all those different, and of course, sustainable development, developing in a way that allows us to continue to develop using water. It's needless to actually point out that more than half of the world's population is located around water bodies, and that's where urbanization and other kinds of development take place. And so we talked about this already. We act as if it matters less. So we get onto a table and we want to address an environmental problem. Politics is always underneath it, boiling. And nobody says, boy, this is a political issue. Let's examine the problems based on who brings onto the table what kind of power relationship or what kind of power package, so that we can examine how those power relationships or power packages would inform the outcome of this negotiation. And then when we get out of it, we say, geez, man, that stuff was really political. But when we're making the negotiations, when we're in place to deliberate, politics is not brought to the surface of it. And I happen to come to the conclusion, like most people who are in this field, that we open new solutions when we explicitly recognize and accommodate hydropolitics or other forms of politics that are pertinent to environmental issues. So if we are on the table negotiating, deliberating to solve or address an environmental problem, and we say, okay, wait a minute, you are in the north of this river basin, you're upstream, and you have all this water is starting in your country or your city, you have that power. You can choose to do whatever you want to do with it. Let's bring that onto the table and say, you're not negotiating or you're behaving like this because it doesn't matter. This water, geography, this water starts in your hometown. We don't bring those issues of who has what kind of power relationship into the way we try to deliberate and solve environmental problems. So I make that point that we should do more of it, because if we examine those power relationships, it becomes obvious the politics that is underneath the table should be brought up to the table, on top of the table. And if that happens, we would have better ways of, we'll have less stagnation in solving environmental problems. And why does it matter in the Pacific Northwest? When I was asked to have this talk, I thought it was a 20-minute talk. So you're probably going to see more than just the Pacific Northwest. But we've talked about difference. If you go east and west of the Cascade, for example, you find different climates. You find different kinds of population distribution. West of the Cascade is mostly urban. East of it is different climate. There's mostly arid and agricultural. And because of those conditions, socioeconomic conditions are also different. Development and land use patterns are different, and livelihood strategies are also different. And because of these differences, water is used in these different ways. These differences are in themselves are agents of power, the political agents, If I live in a place where I have adequate water and you don't, and you depend on me, I have power because I have to give you water, for example. If I live in the city where all the cool technology about building dams and all the brain power about developing machines that will bring water to us exist, I have power because I belong to the city. And I know I hang around and I share the same values or the same uses for water that is different from somebody who is not in the city. And so I have some kind of power. Maybe it's technology, it's knowledge packaged as a whole bunch of devices that I can use to extract and use water.
And it's important to note this. This is 70% of our hydroelectricity or power, hydro or power comes from
hydropower.
70% of electricity used in the state.
It's very unusual to see that. So water in itself is a very, very political, it should be and is a very, very political issue in a place where most of the industries and most of rural urban centers and cities are dependent on water to get energy.
And of course, in the east of the Cascade, agriculture is very prominent. There's water is being used for flood control as well, navigation, in-stream ecology,
salmon as that example. And those of you who go up to the hills and slide on snow, or you go get your boat and get or swim or something, you have recreational and of course psychological benefits from using water. And so hydropolitics is an important issue, not just to those who are in positions of elected or government, but to you as well. If you can't meet your own personal uses or needs for water, then you are constrained from a hydropolitical perspective.
And so most of this is from the Climate Impacts Group, a study they did in 2001. And these are some of the implications of climate change to
the Pacific Northwest. Those of you who like to go and slide,
there's going to be decreased snow covered area.
You're going to, instead of sliding 3 miles, you may just slide one and you might not be as happy.
There will be earlier spring peak flows, which means there will be an increased lag between snow melt and
fall rain. So if you have a certain ecological or water use that is between spring melt and
snow
and fall rains, that availability of water is going to be sort of not very reliable. And so you have a problem right there. And of course, you're deprived of your ability to accomplish certain things. You are politically or hydropolitically handicapped.
There will also be decreased summer stream flow.
If you need water during the summertime, you will have less of it. And so from a hydropolitical perspective, you would be handicapped.
The Columbia River Basin especially will have reduced reservoir system capacity for stream flow requirements for fish.
And if you are in the fishing industry, you would be handicapped. It's an economic handicap, but it's indirectly a hydropolitical handicap because you don't have enough water. There would be reduced power production, so we might not have to have our fancy light bulbs. We might not be able to see each other when we have a conversation. We might not be able to use all the cool technology that is dependent on energy. So hydropolitics is not really about big people making politicians making decisions. It's about your ability to accomplish your everyday life, that of which is dependent on water.
And of course, with all these different things, they predict that there will be more conflict among users or among uses.
And one of the key issues they say they mentioned in that report is that
the Pacific Northwest is also very vulnerable because
the institutional arrangements for managing water are disintegrated. So the municipal water supply people are very different from the people who are in charge of dams and producing electricity, and they don't necessarily have some kind of a Pacific Northwest Army Corps of Engineer version of managing water, which is one single body that is in charge of everything. And because of that, there would be more conflict. Here's the caveat is, every one of these different groups, whether you're a municipal water supply, you have a constituent that you have to defend. So is the salmon people. There's a lot of us here who, even though we don't eat fish, we feel happy because we know that the salmon can go back and forth, and they have to keep doing that.
And so when we're having low stream flows, we'll be going to the reservoir people who are doing power, who are producing power, and sort of renegotiating claims and uses of water. And a lot of different political issues are at play when we start that negotiation. And maybe get the argument that we would have less conflict and we would reach solutions faster and easier if we act as if hydropolitics matters. So when it gets to the point where we have to either adapt or mitigate the impacts of global climate change, and we sit and say, okay, here is the power you bring on the table. This is the kind of power you have with respect to water. Let's examine how these different power relationships can actually influence the way we claim and use water in this curse. As it becomes more scarce, let's figure out ways in which these power relationships can actually influence water use. Then we would reach a solution, or we would be able to solve the problems a lot easier. We've almost unanimously agreed in this hall though, that politics is always someplace, even though and it's always never brought on the table. And so if we act as if it matters, we have a better chance of reaching a solution. And that's why hydropolitics matters to those of us who are in the Pacific Northwest. I also thought I would talk a little bit more on hydropolitics in the Lake Chad Basin. In Central North Africa. It happens to be something near and dear to me. The Lake Chad, the Lake Chad itself, this is what the lake used to look like, this big. And it is in between four countries, or five countries, Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and of course, the Central African Republic and the Sudan and parts of Libya are also within the basin. Just a little bit of Libya is within the basin, the conventional basin of Lake Chad. And this is some facts about it. It used to be.
It's not anymore.
It used to be the fourth largest lake in Africa and one of the largest wetland complex. It is very shallow,
but very expansive. And that is because the shallow,
it's not just shallow, but it's also very variable. So during the rainy season, there's a lot of water. During the dry season, it sort of shrinks a little bit. And it serves those, especially the wetlands, serve as nesting ground for
really, really cute birds. I happened to be there one time when the birds were just done nesting, and they
nest here,
and then they fly to Spain and all the beautiful cities in Europe, but they're really, really nice birds. And a lot of international organizations are very interested in protecting this area because people in Italy or Madrid in Spain are not going to be able to see cute things if the Lake Chad Basin disappears. So that's the power of accomplishing something as bird viewing that depends on the water dynamics in the Lake Chad Basin. But most importantly to some of us is that it supports a whole bunch of livelihood strategies, fishing, agriculture, livestock breeding, and things like that.
And in 1964 in Chad, four countries, Nigeria, Cameroon, Niger, and Chad, got together and created this commission, one big body to manage the waters of the Lake Chad Basin.
It is important to also note here that the Lake Chad Basin is just on the southern edge of the Sahara Desert, an unusual place to find one of the largest lakes in Africa, a place where it's very arid.
And so they found a need to get together and create a convention or a place where they can actually sort of begin to govern and claim and use water as a collective body. And then in 1994, the Central African Republic
was invited to join
by the initiative of Nigeria,
and you would see why if I have time to explain that.
The Sudan was also asked to join,
and is still awaiting ratification,
but Libya is already a member and has been ratified.
That's the kind of politics that we always talk about.
These people have more land in the basin than Libya does, but they're still waiting to ratify them, but Libya is already a member. These people, the Central African Republic, didn't even think twice to do that. And
I will talk later about why this is the case in terms of geography as hydropower or hydropolitics.
But this is what is happening to the lake today. This is where the lake was in 1963. This is where the lake is today. The blue stuff is the lake. Not this. But this is what the lake used to look like.
And there's another kind of political dimension to this, which sort of makes me sometimes want to either cry or laugh really loud, like being stupid.
The dam, there's a whole bunch, between the 70s and the 80s, a whole bunch of dams were created in this area.
In Cameroon, for example, we had the Maga Dam. The Maga Dam was a project that was started by the French colonialists. At that time, they were still in Cameroon. And they said the goal of the Maga Dam was to modernize agricultural production in Africa. And they would make Cameroon more food self-sufficient if they create this dam and then irrigate a whole bunch of... It's like spreading water in a desert so that people can grow rice. And that was supposed to make us food self-sufficient.
And a whole bunch of other dams were built along several tributaries of rivers flowing into the Lake Chad Basin.
And of course, it didn't make us food self-sufficient.
We started losing species, and people started moving away from it.
A whole bunch of people were also displaced as a result of the dam, which is because of water, people lose the ability to accomplish something like living in their homes.
And then, as we speak, there's a lot of conflict among anglers, farmers, grazers, because the amount of water in that area has significantly reduced. Some people actually claim that this is just 1 foot of what it used to be 30 years ago. That's a huge amount of it. And there's a lot of politics implied with it. If you look at the resource use or water use in a location in the Lake Chad Basin, you look, for example, at the annual budget, you would see that Nigeria contributes 52% of the operating budget of the Lake Chad Basin Commission, the governing body of water, and Cameroon about 26%. But if you look at the proportion of irrigated area, Nigeria irrigates about 73% of the land that is under irrigation in the Lake Chad Basin.
Land use and water depletion. Spreading water in the desert to grow rice.
That's some kind of power right there.
And so I look at institutional power relationships, sort of look at the Lake Chad Basin Commission and examine the states.
And I call Nigeria the lead state because they have all different kinds of power that the different nations in the Lake Chad Basin don't have.
And this has implications of why they are irrigating 73% and the other states less.
Nigeria has about 3 times as many institutions of higher learning
than all the other countries in the Lake Chad Basin put together. So they have knowledge to build dams, they have knowledge to irrigate places, they have knowledge and technology to try different things.
And as a matter of fact, since the creation of the Lake Chad Basin Commission, the executive secretary
has always been a Nigerian that has a PhD in water resources management. And that secretariat detects what is being done in the Lake Chad Basin.
From an economic perspective, as a hydropower element, Nigeria, as we already saw, they contribute more than half of the budget, but they are the highest exporter of gas and petroleum.
I believe for the whole of Africa, they are the largest exporter of gas and petroleum. They've got dollars, lots of it,
as compared to the other members of the basin. They have 4 times the GDP of all other states put together.
They produce a lot of things and sell them to people.
The military might is,
there's as many people in Nigeria, I think, in terms of just population, as there are in all the other states put together. It's about 90 or 150 million people.
But they are also not very shy of flexing the military might, the muscles. They have about four times the troops or paramilitary personnel
as all the other nations put together.
They occupy Cameroon, which is an oil-rich place called the Bakassi Peninsula.
For a long period of time. I remember when I was in, I just began college, and there was the ratio of army. We sent
our armies
there to go protect the area because the Nigerians were coming more and more, and they didn't even bother to shoot our army. They just, 50 of them would surround one of them and just beat the soldier to death. They didn't even have to shoot because there was one Cameroonian army to 50 or 100 Nigerian soldiers. And they had all these really cool guns that they wouldn't want to waste on a Cameroonian. They just catch you and beat you up instead. And so they have all this power, and that in itself has a role to play in the way water is claimed and used in the Lake Chad Basin.
But geography is also power. If you look at the waters, that these waters flow upstream out of this. There's two major basins, the Kamadougou-Yobe Basin, which is mostly in Nigeria. This does not flow to the lake anymore. And if you notice in the diagrams I showed you, most of the drying of the lake is up here. Why does it not flow into the lake anymore? Because it's been dammed and used for irrigation. That 70% of irrigation is around here in the basin. But then, this is Central African Republic here, and you can see most of the waters, the headwaters that flow into the lake are here, and that's why the Central African Republic is a member of the Commission. Because they have, by virtue of the geography, they have enough power to bring into the table. We can convince them to let us use the water to bring into the Lake Chad Basin. Cameroon also has a little bit of water flowing to the Logone River Basin. And you can see the Sudan is over here and really doesn't have that much water and doesn't have money, doesn't have military mind. They're still waiting to ratify the membership in the commission. Libya is somewhere here, has no water flowing into it.
It's a very powerful nation. They have a big military. They're very advanced in terms of economics and of course, science and knowledge.
They are already a member of the commission. And they're making big decisions, as you would see. And so I looked at the Fatlami Convention and its status, and I basically call it an economic values manifesto.
Everything about the way water is supposed to be regulated and used is about using the resource, exploiting the resource.
There's very little emphasis on even efficient use, conservation, and sustainability. And there's two different kinds of stories that are being told about why the lake is drying up. The Lake Chad Basin Commission, and if you notice, I put Nigeria right next to it because they control and say everything about the Lake Chad Basin Commission. They're saying that part of the inflow into the lake that is coming from Nigeria, as you saw on the map, is only 5%. Everybody else is saying it's 10%. So they're saying if the political argument here, or the game that is at play, is we can tap as much water as we want from these tributaries because it's only 5%. But it's really not 5%. If we make it really small, then it becomes insignificant. When we get into negotiations, we cannot be talking about me changing my practices because it's only 5% of what really counts. And they're saying that it's not even water use or irrigation that is causing the problem. It is the West.
It's something that if you've ever, how many of you have been to Africa? Yeah, we like to complain about the West. It's like, my foot hurts, oh, Europe, Chinese, it doesn't matter, so long as it's not us. And so
it's the West, and they're burning all these fossil fuels, and our lake is drying up. But other people are saying it's poor water management practices. And they're saying that most of the irrigation systems are owned by the state. And in the cost of building this dam, local people are being disenfranchised. They're not using the water for their own local practices. And so poverty, actually, and the drying of the lake is actually caused by the Lake Chad Basin Commission to a significant extent. But if you belong to that commission, this is your discourse. And that's why this body of mine is a climate refugee in a lot of ways, because it is global warming that is causing problems, not poor management practices. And that makes it very interesting in terms of how you begin solving problems. But here is some data that really doesn't give you room to contest. Those dams were started, if you look at the hydrograph of water in the Lake Chad Basin, it's pretty even in terms of amount of water available there. But then, once you get to the 1970s when they started building the dams, this is where the hydro got. So there's something to say in terms of scientific data, and the Lake Chad Basin Commission wouldn't provide me with this hydrograph. I actually had to go to the office in Chad and spend more than 3 or 4 weeks to be able to get this. Because this actually shows that the dams are actually causing a lot of the problem, not global warming and the West. Libya, who just joined as a member, is now hosting conferences to fix the problems. But look at the title, it's a high-level conference on water for agriculture and energy in Africa, but then they're trying to examine the challenges of global climate change. There's nothing here that says, let's examine the challenges of our malpractices in our water system. And Libya is, and when this is happening in Libya, they are going to say something about global climate change and blame other people for what is going on in the Lake Chad Basin. And so their solution is that they're going to, since Central African Republic is a member now, they're going to just build a canal. Instead of letting the water flow, they'll just build a big canal so that it will push water into the Lake Chad Basin. Libya is already thinking about building another canal to go to Libya. So you get the point. They're just going to dam it and build a big canal, and everybody else who depends on the stream here is going to figure out for themselves what they will have to do with the lives. And so I make the argument that they are in the process of making or creating a hydro security complex, because Cameroon, as corrupt as we are, Niger, as corrupt as they are, all those other countries, they would evolve to become stable, they would gain more knowledge, they would be, it would be more obvious that they're being exploited, and they would have to renegotiate the claims and uses of water. And with all the infrastructure that Nigeria is building around irrigation, they have more irrigated area than there is water. That's why they're trying to build that big canal so that they can finish irrigating all the areas that they've prepared for irrigation. And when it becomes time to renegotiate this, are they willing to give up all the existing infrastructure, the investment, and the productivity that is coming from that? And of course, attention to hydropolitics would be key at those times. Regional stability and development would certainly depend on whether those negotiations and deliberations occur as if hydropolitics matters. Thank you.
What would be a kind of middle of the way solution for the Lake Chad Basin, rather than the total drainage they're doing right now versus the canal? I mean, what would be, so what are other people saying about what could be done to alleviate the problem?
Can you repeat the question?
Okay. Well, the question is, if I got you correctly, is that the drainage, the canal, is a middleware solution.
No. I was saying that's, you know, an extreme solution. Is there something that, like, better practice? What kind of better practices could be done?
Okay, what kinds of better practices could be done in lieu of having a canal? I would openly say to you, I'm not in lieu of a canal. The reason why they're trying to get the canal is because they're denying what is actually causing the problem. What is causing the problem is that you and I know that if you spread water thin, it will evaporate. If you spread water thin in a desert, it's going to evaporate even more. The climate does not permit the kind of irrigation practices that we have. Even in the developed countries like America, sometimes up to 90% of water is lost. Irrigation water is lost through seepage, evaporation. If you look at some of the canals, it's just dirt canals, and they transport it over extended periods, extended distances. So a lot of that water is infiltrating and losing before it even gets to the farm. So they're redistributing water in places where they shouldn't. They're spreading it wide open. Most of the irrigation they're talking about is paddy rice. So they're building all these big rectangles and then pumping surface water into it. So they're spreading water. So that a desert, an arid area, is a place where evapotranspiration is greater than precipitation. And so I would just make it even more easier for evapotranspiration in this place, for more evapotranspiration to happen, so that I can lose more water. That's the practice. We could become more efficient in terms of irrigation. We could also just leave it as is, because there's a lot of people living there that are living their livelihoods with the hydrologic variability of the area. They shouldn't be coming to a place where there's no water to develop agriculture. They're doing that, but we could improve the efficiency of the existing systems that are there without necessarily building a canal. But if we do that, then we will not make a political case to the international community. We're trying to get money for people to help us solve a problem that is created by the West, global warming. This is the irony of it. It's not global warming, okay? Yep, it's land use.
You had an opportunity to look at the Colorado River water region. The fact that it's very little that flows into Mexico. Most of it's taken out to use or.
You mean it's similar to
the situation? Are they trying to negotiate, or are they still trying to negotiate on that? Or?
In the Colorado River?
Yeah.
So you want to repeat the question?
Yeah, the question is, in the most of the Colorado River, or very little of it flows into Mexico because it's being extracted in the U.S. And the question is whether that is being this negotiation going on. I don't know, but if there were a negotiation going on, there is a few things you could understand about the two countries. We're talking about Mexico and the United States. Well, there's a lot of power relationship that makes it almost impossible for Mexico to say anything. Military might, economic might, there's like how many million universities in the United States? There's a lot of smart people here. They can just go talk the Mexicans out of it. And that's hydropolitics. So I don't know if it's being negotiated or not. But if it is being negotiated, those forces come into play. Yeah,
you first. You said that part of the problem here in the Pacific Northwest is that we don't have one central governing unit for our hydropolitics. Do you know if there's anything in the works? Because we know that in the near future it's going to be an issue, or are we just saying we'll figure it out when the future comes?
I honestly don't have a clue. The question is, the problem is, one of the problems, or what makes the Pacific Northwest also very vulnerable to the impacts of global climate change is that they have a disintegrated institutional arrangement. And do I know if something is in the works? As far as I know, the global the climate impacts group on campus has called that a warning, and they've published a couple of papers about that issue being an element of vulnerability. I don't know if there's anything trying to put those different institutions together. And it's an interstate thing, because the Pacific Northwest is not just Seattle or Washington. It's Idaho, it's Oregon, it's parts of the Columbia up in Canada. So there's getting a body together to actually do that. I don't know how feasible that is, but I also don't know if something is going on along those lines. Yep, Kristen.
Could you talk a little bit about the fish as a food resource in that lake? And mm-hmm. Obviously, are the fish all gone now because it's all channelized?
Oh, yeah. And that is something that I did a study. I was a member of a Makoto scholar with the Interdisciplinary Center for Global Climate Change at the University of Minnesota. So they found some money to ship me to the Lake Chad Basin, and I went there when it was the fishing season, and everybody was complaining because they don't even have enough to eat of the fish. Well, I saw a lot of fish, but it wasn't enough because the water goes away and they dry a lot of it and eat it until the water comes back. there is a lot of problems being able, some of the fish species have disappeared. I think only about 8% of those fish species are actually still in the basin. And there's a lot of issues with anglers fighting because they're starting to drill holes in recession agricultural areas where animals come and graze. And the animals are falling in it and breaking their legs because they're drilling those holes to stagnate water so that the fish can stay there. And most of the fish that is alive there are fish that would burrow into mud. I don't know how they call them, but then they just stay in the mud and until you pull them out or they die or something or they can't fall. And so those fish are the ones that are surviving that. But yeah, there's a lot of issues with fish. Well, did you have your hand up?
Yeah. Yeah, you know. The country to the southeast, it says the African Republic, the one that has all the upper watersheds to feed into the lake.
Oh, on the southeast, it's Central African Republic.
Central African Republic. What's preventing them from exercising some power, given that they have all the feeders in the country? Why have neighbors?
Nigeria has four times as much army as people in the Central African Republic. Nigeria has a GDP that is four times greater, so Nigeria sends food and sells food to them at cheaper prices. Nigeria gives them arms to protect especially the government against its people, because it's not a democracy, okay? And so the guy who is the president needs to stay there no matter how much water he has to give away. And so if Nigeria is behind your back, your people don't matter. And so it's very difficult for them to even want to claim water because the government in itself is not acting in the best interest of the people.
We're out of time, but I think we demonstrated hydroponics dragon. Right? Yeah.